Well, Hina Jilani, as a human rights pioneer in Pakistan, you must despair at the state of human rights in Pakistan right now.
Yes, I do. But as you know, human rights defenders can never afford to despair of anything. So we have to find a way of to hope always that things will improve. One of the bright sides of this whole situation in Pakistan is that we have a very strong human rights movement and a very strong and a very credible women's rights movement. So a lot of faith in their ability to take things forward.
So how can you explain or reconcile the recent stoning to death of 25-year-old pregnant woman Farzina Parveen?
I think mostly it is the failure of the state, in fact, where the state agents present at the place were not able to stop this kind of barbaric incident from happening. It wasn't actually stoning to death in the sense that, you know, people usually understand it as a form of punishment. It was actually the opportunistic use of bricks lying around to kill that woman, because they tried to shoot her down, and when she wasn't shot, they picked up whatever they could to hit her with it. And so the police were there. I think in some ways it's very important to understand that while some action has happened in terms of bringing new legislation in to confront this issue of honor killings, The state has never really used the law to deter incidents or to make the law an instrument of social change. And here I think the civil society also, despite all its efforts, doesn't seem to have gained much in terms of changing the mindset of the society.
So the question then remains, you say there's a strong human rights movement in Pakistan, but it's not translated into the country's institutions. How does that occur?
That occurs, unfortunately, because of a very confused state and a polity that does not recognize the fact that we've entered into the 21st century. We have, on the one hand, a great eagerness to protect certain laws that were brought in by a military regime and not necessarily reflecting religious injunctions, but in the name of religion. These laws are still practiced. They put in a very strong obstruction to the implementation of human rights, especially with regard to the right to security, the right to life, and the right to physical integrity, particularly of women.
So how can you explain these killings of women? What do they tell us about life in Pakistan?
Well, they certainly tell us that the Pakistani state certainly needs to do much more than it has done so far in terms of making laws operational, so that there is a complete sense that there will be no impunity for violating women's right to life, violating their right to liberty and their freedom of movement, and in fact giving women more dignity.
But the Human Rights Commission in Pakistan, which you founded, says that at least 860 women were victims of these murders last year. The estimate, that's a gross underestimate from what you and others say. How is it that people carry out these killings with relative impunity?
It's because, as I said, the failure of the state. At the local level, the police does not respond. And, you know, when a woman is killed by her own family, there's no one really to pursue the case. And the state either turns its face away or actively helps those who have perpetrated the crime to escape any kind of punishment. I'm afraid it's not just state institutions and agencies like the law enforcement. Even the judiciary has really not played an important role in making sure that impunity doesn't prevail in such cases. Now, of course, there's a lot of talk about ending impunity for this, and I think we have actually brought the society to a state where nobody will openly justify or condone honor killings, but in practical effect, nothing really has happened.
I want to get to where the state's falling down in prosecuting these crimes in more detail in a moment, but if we can go back to how does a society exist where people feel that they can carry out these crimes against their own family members. Can you try and explain to us who don't understand life in Pakistan how on earth people believe that this is a just way to carry out justice, if you like?
You know, I really don't think it's important to explain it. It's more important to fight it. And that's what I do. And a lot of people like me do. We know that this is not a state of affairs that is in any way acceptable to the society at large, and particularly to the women of Pakistan, who have now gathered the kind of awareness that they need to know that they have the right to dignity, they have the right to life, and they have the right to make a choice.
But that same mindset that exists, that allows these people to carry out these crimes, must also pervade the people in power, the institutions, the legal institutions that fail to act on them. So can
Absolutely.
You explain that mindset?
You see, that mindset is there. But as I explained earlier, we have brought the class that's ruling, for instance, legislators, etc., to a state where no legislator will now get up in the parliament and say this is a part of our culture and we will not do anything about it, which is what they did say. The Senate in Pakistan resisted a resolution against honor killing in 1999 and by saying this. But now this is not what they can ever say. They will pass a number of resolutions. They will pass laws. The question is, will they put the support of social policy of the state behind the law that they create?
Well, you're a member of the Elders, a group of world elders, including Kofi Annan, Lakhdar Brahimi, Jimmy Carter. Nelson Mandela was its founder. And the idea of this group, if I understand it correctly, is to guide countries on issues of democracy and human rights. Have you had much influence in Pakistan?
Well, my influence in Pakistan doesn't really start with my becoming a part of the Elders. I am a part of the human rights movement, which is one of the most credible movements in Pakistan and does enjoy public credibility. And that's the influence that we have in terms of influencing state policy. But, you know, in a country like Pakistan, where you have intermittent democracy only, usually it's a military regime. How much of an influence can you have on a military dictator who has come into existence as a result of a coup, where democratic values do not prevail, the right to participation is not recognized, especially participation in governance? So really, it's an unresponsive state in most of the times.
And I suspect, as a woman too, you probably get short shrift in a country where women's rights are not upheld.
Well, yes, generally that's true. But I think that by now, women's rights have been put on a priority agenda of all political elements in Pakistan, including the very conservative Islamic elements. So nobody can now say that there's no need to give attention to women's rights. But then, as I said, this is all more in terms of a rhetoric, or useful for public consumption. But in actual fact, the state does fail most of the time to bring about the change that we require in order to ensure that women in Pakistan are no more a population at risk.
Have you had direct dealings with the government of Nawaz Sharif?
Yes, on many issues, especially on women's rights issues. There have been several attempts made by us to make sure that this government has an open policy on entertaining civil society concerns and to doing something about it. Unfortunately, again, the situation in Pakistan is such that rights right now are not a priority with a government that's fighting for its own life with the dominating question of civil-military relationship. So that's taking all their attention. And we have a state where terrorism is rife. It is a state which has unfortunately been unwilling or unable to deal with the question of religious extremism. So there are so many questions that have to be responded to by a particular government. So despite the fact that we are given assurances that things will happen, things do get delayed.
Well, you rightly mentioned Nawaz Sharif's government being unable to quell the violence by the Taliban, and the recent attack on Karachi's airport is testament to that fact, that they are unable to deal with the pervasive influence of the Taliban. How precarious is Nawaz Sharif's grip on power in that country, do you think?
You know, the elections did bring forward a very clear mandate in his favor. But at the same time, I think people need to understand that no civilian government is really stable unless and until the military is either able to get it to subscribe to some of the priorities and the agenda that the military has. So that's one problem with Nawaz Sharif's ability to take on issues head on. The other, of course, is his own hesitation in taking on issues where he would really have to show real leadership and turn the population from a confused perception of what the Taliban are and make sure that the state remains secure against these forces. But there again, the military dominance over decision-making on what is to happen is something that will always be a clear indication of what will actually take place. And I don't think Nawaz Sharif will be able to change that.
What's your view of the use of drones in Pakistan to target these terrorists? Human rights groups have condemned their use because of the numbers of civilians killed by them. But do they have any role in weeding out terrorism?
Look, the point is that whether they have a role in weeding out terrorism or not, the question is, does international law allow this? It does not. And I think that I would rather weed out terrorism within the imperatives of the rule of law rather than outside of that. And the reason of that for that is not only because I think that human rights must prevail and the rule of law must prevail, but there is a political and a very pragmatic reason for this thinking, which is that you don't give criminals and terrorists the opportunity to be to pose as martyrs of aberrations from the rule of law. That is not what we want. We want people to clearly understand that these people are criminals, and regular trials of these criminals will bring forth and expose the criminal acts that these people are committing. Here, what you do is you use drones, you use extrajudicial killings or disappearances, and the result is that people never get to know that these are people who have killed almost 50,000 civilians in Pakistan, because the victims are almost invisible as there are no public trials. So I think these are some of the things that we are grappling with and trying to fight counterterrorism measures that are so apparently counterproductive. And also remember that human rights defenders were the first targets of these terrorists. Our struggle against extremism and terrorism based on religion starts much before 9/11 in this region where terrorism has the strongest roots. But we are the ones who are saying, don't fight it with extra legal measures. Fight it within the rule of law, so that what these people intend to do, which is to destroy the rule of law, should not be something that will happen.
Do you have confidence then, or are you more hopeful, I suppose, that the government of Nawaz Sharif can sufficiently strengthen the law to weed out terrorism, to improve human rights, to uphold the rights of women in Pakistan?
I see no reason why any government, including that of Nawaz Sharif, cannot do that. The question is not the fact that they cannot. The question is, will they? Is there a political will to do it?
And do you have an answer to that?
Not yet. I know that there's no will in the because there is no action that we have seen which is effective enough to give us the confidence that eventually it will. But look, Pakistan has all the institutions. Pakistan has a strong law enforcement system. Pakistan also has a very strong military. It's not a banana republic, really. So with the fact that there are all the instruments that can be used, why they have not been used effectively enough with the force of the will of the political element as well as the military, that is a question that disturbs us all.
Hina Jilani, lovely to talk to you. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you.